what facts you throw at any congressperson, Democratic or Republican, right? Their idea is to fund the police more. But this is money that should be going to the public. This is like, for example, here in Chicago, in 2020, the mayor asked the public, like, hey, how would you like to sort the budget out? And 80% of the people voted that, hey, we should defund the police and put that money back into other things that could really help out the community.
Crime data in the United States is often late or unreported. But what is certain is that since the coronavirus lockdowns, murders have increased by at least 30%. But what statistics cannot capture is the widespread sentiment that the violence in today's United States is more brutal, shocking, and random than it was in years past. While the U.S. is by far the most armed nation per capita, other countries have high rates of gun ownership, but not the regular violence which makes American life uniquely precarious and fearful. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
In the crowded and bustling lane of South Delhi suburbs, it's a carnival here every day. People flock to this market every evening to buy a central market can offer. With lanes and by-lanes across the street, this is a shopping heaven among local Muslims. Zaid, a local shopkeeper, says this market is very popular, especially among women, and in demand these days are Islamic outfits of latest designs. Outfits such as abayas and hijabs, prayer outfits and niqab, thobes and jubbas and sportswear are trending.
We usually have demand for the latest variety of clothing, especially young college students. Our business always been good, but since that hijab broke controversy, the sales of abayas and other related dresses has gone up.
Shagufta, a student, says it's not all about hijab, but it's about my choice to wear hijab. She says rather than politicians indulging in matters of Muslims that fetches vote, why don't they stop hate crimes, lynchings, and bulldozing Muslim homes? Anti-Islamic elements want to portray to the world that Islam is about oppressing women, but in reality, it's about protecting women, safeguarding women, and treating them with utmost dignity.
I have chosen this dress and it's the right way and the right path, I think. The Islamic dress makes me safe, secured, and above all, it looks beautiful on women in general. Actually, it's my choice because God Almighty wants me to cover myself in order to preserve my beauty.
Based on reports and market evaluations, Islamic clothing market will see a massive growth by 2028. Many brands are in line for manufacturing.
Many women I spoke with believe that this hijab row is nothing more than a political stunt ahead of upcoming elections. They say political parties are exploiting such issues to galvanize people into voting for them.
In recent months, ban on Islamic headscarves or hijab in southern India outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith or choice, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric flared more aggressively since ruling BJP attained power in 2014. They say most elections in India since 2014 have been overly polarized and religious divide has been the trump card to garner votes and win elections. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
A headquarters not far from the front line, on the outskirts of Donetsk. Russian soldiers are on rotation, about to head to the front to replace their comrades. On the way, it's tense. Russian forces are making a major attempt to overrun Ukrainian positions that have been largely static for 8 years. The soldier thinks he hears a drone. Both sides are dropping grenades on each other.
I was at this position about a month ago. It was reasonably quiet. Now it's a different story. Incoming artillery, small arms fire. The outskirts of Donetsk has now become one of the places of most fierce fighting in this war.
We run across open ground. The Ukrainian lines are only 100 meters away. Our position is hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, and we are hurried underground. Europeans are once again slaughtering each other in brutal trench warfare. As tension grows between the Western and Eastern worlds, these soldiers aren't the only ones concerned that the next world war may well be already underway in this wintry gray zone wasteland in Donbass. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Hamas's Council on International Relations has held an international conference on the impact of the Israeli blockade. The event aims to shed light on the crippling Israeli blockade on more than 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. The event was attended by figures representing the Gaza Government Committee and civil society organizations. They discussed ways to tackle the repercussions of the blockade. Living conditions and the standard of living in the Gaza Strip have been rapidly deteriorating under the Israeli blockade. The Hamas movement says Western countries, mainly the United States, are supporting the Israeli blockade.
The Israeli siege, unfortunately supported by the international community, mainly the Americans, have converted Gaza into the biggest open-air prison on earth. We can see the catastrophic impacts of this siege in every corner here in the Gaza Strip, which can develop up to a crime against humanity or an ethnic cleansing.
Speakers via video conference included Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Palestine, as well as Richard Falk, the chairman of the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Statistics show that most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive because of the blockade.
More than 2 million Palestinians, most of them children, women, elders, and patients, are suffering from this catastrophic condition due to the continuous blockade for more than 15 years. The international community silence leads to continue such offensive on Palestinians.
Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed under the blockade. At the conference, attendees called for the immediate lifting of the inhumane siege.
This is a call to the world to stop its a silence over what's been going on the Gaza Strip, and to urge all governments of the world in Europe and the United States and other parties around the world to intervene actively to end this illegal and punishing siege on the Gaza Strip population.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Gaza Strip is already devastated by the Israeli blockade and is edging closer to breaking point. The prolonged blockade has undermined all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Experts say the inhumane Israeli practices have deprived Palestinians of their rights. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Back on November 28, 2019, an American drone strike hit a car returning from a maternity hospital in southeastern Afghanistan. The attack left 5 people dead, including a woman who had just given birth, 3 of her relatives, and the driver. The Afghan people, especially the relatives of victims, remembered the U.S. drone strikes as terrifying and unforgivable.
The targeted people were members of my uncle's family. They were martyred cruelly and horrifically. After giving birth to her son, my aunt's situation worsened. Then they left for the hospital together with my cousins. When returning from the hospital, their car was bombed by a U.S. drone strike. In total, 3 women, a boy called Nora John, and the driver, Muhammad Nabi, were martyred.
The U.S. crimes in Afghanistan are unforgivable. In fact, the U.S. government supported and empowered terrorists on our land and hurt civilians and innocent people. Now, as facts are surfacing, we understand that the U.S. war on terror was a game and a pretext to justify America's presence in the region.
Human rights advocates stress that such attacks show the reality of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. They criticize the failure of the U.S. to account for civilian victims of its airstrikes.
We have proof that the U.S. and its allies committed war crimes in Afghanistan. During their night raids, mass bombardments, and land missions, many innocent people were killed and their properties were damaged. The 2019 U.S. drone attack in Khost is one of many instances. Today, the families of victims are calling for investigations into such unlawful killings and compensation for their losses.
According to verified reports, throughout the two-decade U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, over 13,000 airstrikes were conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed up to 10,000 people, including many women and children. Afghan people are still suffering from the wounds inflicted by the U.S. occupation of their country. They call for justice for American forces' atrocities on their soil. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bakeries from around Italy have warned the government that their activities are at risk of shutting down if they won't receive financial help as soon as possible. Trade associations and representatives of the bakery industry met the Business and Made in Italy Minister Adolfo Urso on Friday to demand subsidies and safeguard measures to tackle the dramatic rise in the cost of raw materials, such as flour, diesel oil, packaging, and equipment.
Flour has gone up from around 4.5 euros per kilo to around 8 euros. The cost of mozzarella has gone up by 30%, that of tomatoes has doubled, and the same goes with cost of equipment. The government must do something to save bakeries, as we are disappearing. The quality and freshness of products from small specialized stores like ours is hard to beat.
Smaller family-owned bakery shops in Italy are slowly disappearing, giving place to large supermarkets. A cost-of-living crisis, rising inflation and energy prices have badly affected many of the around 26,000 bakeries, which employ about 100,000 workers across the country. Power bills have doubled in Italy over the past months amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war. This is while the country's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
All prices have increased a lot. The cost of energy, raw materials, everything has gone up by at least 40%.
Prices have gone up also in supermarkets where there is no more food in offer. But where prices have gone insane is at work. I am employed by a communication agency and the quotations we receive have doubled.
Earlier this week, the Giorgia Meloni government announced its draft 2023 budget bill, which includes measures aimed at channeling 35 billion euros towards families and businesses in order to ease the burden of high inflation and power bills. Many fear these measures will do little to shield the Italians. Max Civili, Rome.
Tens of thousands of activists from Imran Khan's PTI party, who came from all across Pakistan, chanted anti-government slogans demanding immediate elections, accusing the government for what they called following US-backed policies. The protesters held the ruling party responsible for the current economic crisis. They said Imran Khan is the only leader who could bring political and economic stability to Pakistan.
Our leader Imran Khan is fighting with the corrupt mafia who was brought by the US. Our struggle is for the rule of law in the country, and that is only possible when Imran Khan will be in power.
Having survived an assassination attempt during his anti-government march on the 3rd of November, former Prime Minister Imran Khan joined the protesters in person for the first time in 3 weeks amid stringent security. Khan told his supporters that although his life is under threat, he will continue his political struggle until his demands are met.
This imported government was brought to a US conspiracy for corruption purposes. We will not accept this puppet regime and we will fight till the end for fresh polls. We will dissolve our provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in days to come.
While calling Khan's long march a flop show, the government says that it will complete its constitutional term and the electoral process will be held at its scheduled time. Imran Khan supporters say the recent massive mass rallies indicate Imran Khan's increasing popularity in his political domain. However, it is highly believed that his party will face tough political competition if the scheduled general elections are held according to the government's plan. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek-Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The United States wars around the world have destroyed many lives. The U.S. regime has also inflicted breakdown of the economy, public health, security, and infrastructure upon the war-torn countries. Some countries have been massively impoverished by the U.S. conflicts. A large part of the population in these countries faces some level of food insecurity, and children are at risk of acute malnutrition. Some regions are currently facing famine. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV reported, on November 28, 2019, an American drone strike hit a car returning from a maternity hospital in southeastern Afghanistan. The attack left five people dead, including a woman who had just given birth, three of her relatives, and a driver. The Afghan people, especially the relatives of the victims, remember the U.S. drone strikes as terrifying and unforgivable. Human rights advocates stress that such attacks show the reality of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. They criticize the failure of the U.S. regime to account for civilians victims of its airstrikes. According to verified reports, throughout the two decades of U.S. occupation on Afghanistan, over 13,000 airstrikes were conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed up to 10,000 people, including many women and children. The Afghan people are still suffering from the wounds inflicted by the U.S. during its occupation of the country. They want justice over the atrocities committed by the American forces on their soil. Meanwhile, Middle East Eye noted, ahead of a trip to Saudi Arabia this year, U.S. President Joe Biden said he would be the first president to visit the West Asia region since 9/11 without U.S. troops engaged in a combat mission there. But the lack of troops in action has not stopped the U.S. from maintaining a military presence in the region. And one area where this is perhaps most pertinent is Somalia, a country in which the U.S. has been engaged in a long-standing fight against groups. Yet beyond the major headlines, not much is known about the exact nature of the American military operation in Somalia, an overshadowed and overlooked theater in the U.S. so-called War on Terror. MEE takes a look at why the U.S. military is in Somalia and what kind of military operation it's running in the Horn of Africa. President Donald Trump's administration moved to withdraw all 700 American troops from Somalia in 2020 after a three-decade presence in the country. Soon after the Biden administration came into office, it reversed the Trump move, and in May 2022, U.S. officials said the president approved a plan to redeploy troops to Somalia. The reason given for the move was as a part of the Biden administration's strategy to try to reduce the threat from Al-Shabaab, an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group that has enjoyed a resurgence in Somalia in recent years. A U.S. official told New York Times that Washington was targeting a small leadership cadre and in particular, looking to target individuals suspected of playing roles in developing plots outside Somalia's borders. The physical U.S. military presence in Somalia is relatively small, numbering around 500 troops. However, the so-called counterterrorism operation the U.S. is conducting is wide-ranging and employs a tactic which has received much criticism from rights groups over the past two decades, drone warfare. And despite the concerns raised over the use of armed drones in areas in which the U.S. is not formally engaged in, a combat mission, the Biden administration has launched the rapid pace of airstrikes in the country. In June, U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, conducted an airstrike in Somalia that reportedly killed five members of Al-Shabaab. In July, another airstrike killed two militants. A month later, AFRICOM conducted at least five airstrikes that reportedly killed 17 Al-Shabaab terrorists. In September, AFRICOM said it killed 27 fighters in a strike. Last month, AFRICOM announced that it conducted an airstrike that killed one Al-Shabaab leader and that no civilians were injured or killed. And just this month, it conducted an airstrike in which AFRICOM said it killed 17 Al-Shabaab fighters. In October, Biden signed a new classified policy to limit so-called counterterrorism drone strikes outside conventional war zones. The new policy is meant to solidify the limits that the administration imposed early into its tenure, which served as a temporary stopgap against the Trump administration's moves to loosen oversight. However, Sarah Harrison, a senior fellow at the International Crisis Group, stated in a piece for Just Security that the new policy would likely have little effect on U.S. operations in Somalia, given that it contains loopholes that will likely to allow business as usual for U.S. AFRICOM in Somalia. The U.S. Congress is the branch of the American government that has the authority to declare war. Despite Congress not having declared war in Somalia and other parts of the world, the Biden administration has used 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, AUMF, to bypass restrictions. The open-ended nature of the 2001 AUMF has allowed multiple presidents to wage war against a number of groups, including Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, and IS. It has been applied in countries including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. And while the Biden administration has signaled it supports ending the different 2002 AUMF, specifically for Iraq, it has not shown any support for revoking the wider-ranging 2001 AUMF, despite calls from lawmakers. The Somali government has recently asked the U.S. to step up its drone strikes on Al-Shabaab targets to include those who might pose a threat to Somali forces, even if they are not firing upon them at the moment. The Biden administration is weighing the request, which would mean a significant escalation by Washington. In August, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin lauded the country's military operation in Africa, saying it works alongside our friends as full partners to strengthen bonds, to tackle common threats, and to advance a shared vision of an Africa whose people are safe and prosperous. But a recent report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies contradicted this, saying militant group violence in Africa has risen inexorably over the past decade, expanding by 300% during this time. In Somalia alone, the Pentagon recorded 2,221 violent events, with battles between Al-Shabaab and the country's state security forces making up 72% of them. And the report noted that Somalia's Al-Shabaab was linked to 36% of all militant group violence recorded in Africa in the past year. The U.S. has spent roughly $2.5 billion on security assistance for Somalia since 2009, according to data from the Center for International Policy. And since 2007, it has conducted at least 265 air strikes, according to AirWars.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Say that the U.S. has a gun problem is an understatement, but when it seems like it can't get any worse, it does. A report has revealed that America's gun epidemic is deadlier than ever. Firearm deaths surged in the U.S. during the COVID-19, killing a record number of people in 21, a 25% increase in fatalities in just 2 years. That has never happened. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why this recurring nightmare is not dealt with in the U.S., especially, for example, by the Democrats who have promised that they would, while looking at how there are vast disparities in who's dying from gun-related violence. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Malik Abdul, GOP strategist and political analyst from Washington, D.C. Also joining us, Frank Emspach, Workers Independent News from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I'd like to welcome you both. I'll start first with you, if I may, Malik Abdul. Take the study, which has analyzed firearm deaths over the past 3 days. This has been very telling. It's unfortunate news for the U.S., but we're looking at a total of what it has recorded to be a million lives, and I repeat, a million lives lost since the year 1990, surging in the U.S. during the COVID-19 pandemic especially, which has killed a record number of people also for the year 2021. When you hear about this study and this revelation in particular, what do you think? What reaction do you have?
Well, obviously, that's a million. Well, that's a very large number. I think it's important when we're having this conversation around guns and violence in the United States and really anywhere around the world, is that it focuses a lot on the guns themselves, which, of course, were ultimately used to commit whatever crime or murder or whatever that may have you. But it's also worth noting that the majority of the people who legally own guns are not involved in any type of crimes. We have a problem or a proliferation, if you will, of illegal guns on the streets. And when you couple that with what's happening in many of our communities, issues like poverty, and just like in the United States, as it is in anywhere around the world, the crime is typically isolated around more impoverished areas. So when you have, you know, poverty, you have more opportunities for crime and vice. And so all of those things kind of factor into this gun debate. So it's not so much just the guns themselves problem. It's a people problem. It's a government regulation problem. It's a combination of things that's not just isolated to the gun itself.
So when you say that we shouldn't restrict it just to the gun itself, because you have many who own guns, and that's okay, it's part of the Constitution, it's their right, that it doesn't involve them, but we have to look at the underlying reasons, I'm understanding you correctly, as to why guns are used, again, generally speaking, where it's committed. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's it. And I say that because it's the case not just here in the United States. Let's just take guns out of it. If you think of crime, wherever you are around the world, typically happens in areas that are more impoverished. You typically don't see crime here in the United States or in the UK or otherwise. You don't see crime. Don't see crime, and definitely violent crime, in high-income areas and very upper-middle-class areas, because they typically have the resources. They're, you know, have the money. They may be able to pay for security, or their schools are great. So there's a number of things we need to consider when we're talking about even how to tackle the issue of violence in America, because it isn't just the government's at the fault of the government or necessarily gun manufacturers. It's a combination of things they have to consider.
Indeed. We're going to hopefully get to all of that, of course. But we need to obviously focus on this particular at there, Frank Emspach, which based on analysts who said that at this time we have seen a dramatic increase that is unparalleled. And it's talking about during the time of the COVID pandemic from 2019 up to the year 2021, last year, we've seen over 25%, that's 25% increase in fatalities in 2 years alone. That has never happened. What do you think? Why do you think that occurred during the time the pandemic hit?
Well, I don't think anybody has a clue, except that you changed the entire way the society was organized essentially overnight. People were constrained, people were at home, people were cooped up. And you had a complete change in the way the job market was functioning, and all these things happened at once. And so I think all kinds of tensions increased, and the way those tensions are expressed here is through a violent reaction. So I think that makes sense. I think that what is distressing is that from 1990 until a couple of years ago, the general rate of crime and gun violence was falling to an extent, and now it's not. I also think we need to just to say a few things about crime. We're focusing on crimes that you see as violent crime out in the street, somebody shooting somebody. We just watched a crime, if you want to call it that, of the collapse of Bitcoin, where about 300,000 people are going to find those only money. Well, you know, is that a crime too? So when we talk about crime here, the theory in the people's minds is generally violent crime, crimes against property and crimes against people, the kind of crime that's committed in high-income areas, financial fraud and all this other stuff, that's not part of the picture in people's minds. So I'm not so sure that everybody in the upper part of the United States, the upper 5%, is crime-free, as we'd like to say. However, the problem that we have here is that every single part of the social safety net, whatever it is, whether it's mental health, access in rural communities, drug use among white people in rural communities and black people in the cities and so forth, all of these things are essentially out of control. And the resources that we need across the board, a mental health officer in each school, for example, with the ability to actually do something, mental health treatment after the kid leaves school, or whatever, the ability to, if you're arrested in this country, the system of bail, where if you're poor, you wind up in jail, you know, and your family is destroyed, you lose your job, and so on and so forth. All of these things contribute to increased social tension. And a way out for many, many people, or at least people perceive it, is to be armed and deal with it. So there's this whole panoply of things. I would argue that it is that we don't understand stuff. For instance, I wrote in a book I just finished that 50%, of the 10 white children that grew up with our family in Lynn, Massachusetts, are dead of drug overdose. Okay, my kids are 50. So we're talking about this happening 30 years ago, not just this week in West Virginia. So these are long-standing issues here. Okay, that we have not addressed as a country. And all of them come together. I think we're magnified by COVID, but come together at this point. The means people, however, is another story. And I think we need to discuss that as well.
Yeah, we need to discuss what you mentioned, where we're looking at industries here. One is the pharmaceutical industry, I think, which I'm getting that impression. Of course, we can't spend time in this, unfortunately, in this program about that. And I would have loved to talk to you about FTX and how that went down in terms of what you mentioned there about Bitcoin. But let's move on. Let's talk reform, if we can, Malik Abdel. And you know, people in the U.S. are begging for reform, that reform that works. Now, tell me what you think about what President Joe Biden did with this Safer Communities Act, which is described as the most significant reform legislation to pass on Capitol Hill since the 1990s. But at the same time, you're having a record number of deaths. So it doesn't look like it's working. What do you think about this legislation? I mean, from what I'm looking at here, it's really $750 million in funding for states to implement red flag laws. I mean, is it attacking the heart of the problem? Because obviously the deaths is just increasing.
Yeah, so I think you are actually referencing, maybe even unwittingly, contradiction and the Joe Biden's, well, the push for Democrats and the Safer Communities Act. There are things in there that obviously in any piece of legislation that certain communities can benefit from, things around, you know, community, invest in community and things like that. Those things are always popular. But the contradiction in those is that many of these things that we're talking about don't necessarily address or are really intended even to solve the issues on the ground. Unfortunately, and I say this a lot, one of the things that is missing in the conversations that we have around gun violence or any, not just gun violence, violent crime in general, is that we don't focus enough on the personal accountability angle. Yes, there are a lot of systemic things that may lead to people into crime or to commit violence. But at the end of the day, most of us know the difference between right and wrong. And so there's a problem of violence in America that is exacerbated. We see it in our, I would actually say, our music industry, where we kind of glorify gang culture. We glorify, it's a very hyper-masculine, alpha male type of environment that we have out there. And we see many kids in communities trying to mimic that sort of behavior in their everyday lives. And so all of these things, and I agree with my colleague, you know, when he references how there's a panoply of issues at play here, and we don't even have enough time in this discussion to get into all of them, but there are things that, like red flag laws that states do have, but even in those states, they have red flag laws. Those things aren't 100% certain to prevent the crimes that we're talking about. So it's a really, it's a Gordian knot, I would say, trying to tackle what would stop it, because I don't think anything would prevent it. Can kind of do things around the edges, teeter around the edges to try to minimize the gun violence and even the impact of such. But I don't think, much like poverty, you know, I would love to get rid of poverty. I don't think we're going to get rid of poverty just as well as I don't think that we're going to get rid of gun violence in the United States.
Well, first of all, when it comes to gun sales, I have to mention this Frank M. Spack, where in the U.S., Americans bought almost 20 million guns last year. I really had to check that out and did a fact check on this. And that's the case. 20 million guns, second highest year on record. 19.9 million was the actual figure. It was actually down 12.5% from 2020, but 2021 was still the industry's second busiest year on record. Are we looking at the fact that, what are we looking at when we take a look at a figure like that, that Americans are out buying guns in these numbers?
You're looking at a number of people who are fearful and paranoiac. I mean, basically, they're afraid of their neighbors. But let's be serious here. Growing up, guns, went hunting and so on and so forth. I don't think that's not what we're really focusing on here. When you talk about crime in the streets and guns and this, that, and the other thing, you are talking about the availability of two different types of weapons. Weapons designed not to go hunting, but to kill people. Either small ones that you can carry easy, like a small pistol, or an AR-15. But from my point of view, there's no base for everybody wandering around with an AR-15. I think that in that sense, eliminating some of the hardware or making it much more difficult to get it would have a positive effect. Wouldn't end things, but it would make it more difficult. Which is be a nice thing, because then maybe fewer people were killed, particularly in these mass shootings, which has got everybody's attention, because almost all of them have been committed by somebody who has access to high-capacity weapons of one sort or another, not hunting rifles and not, you know, a little 22 for target shooting. So to focus on that type of armament, in my view, makes perfect sense. That would make sense. But the other parts of this, it's true, you have a red flag law, but, you know, there are so many loopholes in it, and you have to make sure that even if somebody is targeted under those laws, that it's fair and equitable for it. But that somebody follows up. On two or three of these occasions in the last year, you've had the police say, oh, yeah, we knew about this person, or we'd heard about it, and there was nothing overt there, so we didn't do anything. And that comes back to that the overt, you know, well, one reasons that you have mental health and all these other things is to intervene prior. Well, there's very little intervention. So in different points here, provision of the equipment, intervention, identification of people, and so on and so forth, the system breaks down. It doesn't function. And I think you have to address each of those in order to begin to make a difference. That's just one thing. The other here mentioned, you know, the music. Well, try this. If you take the mainstream television in this country, I would defy anybody to say that there's a popular show or any show that deals with conflict management from the point of view of actually managing it, other than a police show. We have 8 hours, 6 hours a night of cop shows on the major things, and they're all dealt with pretty much the same script. You don't have a show about how are we going to get together and work a community to deal with gun violence, something where that's non-conflictual.
Well, why isn't there? That's a good point. I mean, why is it? Let me ask our guest Malik Abdel about that, because I want to get into the music thing too. But why aren't there? Why isn't there? I'm not in the States. I'm not keep with what's going on in terms of talk show having. Why isn't there a program that have so many deaths in the U.S. of how to, as our guest Frank Imspach said, conflict management or how to handle only in terms of the psyche behind it or the I guess the approach to it, perhaps if I'm saying it properly. What do you think?
Yeah. So those shows. What you're talking about are things that exist in segments as part of, but it's not devoted. There are no shows obviously devoted to that specific issue itself, but it is covered in truth, and it's covered even our movies or TV series. So you do see that sort of conflict resolution within these type of shows, but no, there is no dedicated show to those. And in large part, I would imagine it's because it probably would not be popular. We kind of like and glorify to an extent violence. We like violent movies. And I'm not talking about war movies or things on the battlefield. I'm saying we like gory, violent movies and violent images, and all of those things kind of factor in. We have conversations oftentimes when people are talking about video games and how someone just sits in a room and shoots video games. There are studies been kind of all over the place with whether or not it's really impactful. Is that type of environment where you're just kind of locked in a room and you're shooting a game all day? But there are places around the other places around the world where they also have video games and kids play video games, and you see the level of violence and definitely gun violence in places around the world. So things people try to use as scapegoats, but there's a much more holistic conversation. And I think that's the only thing that I can continue to go back to is that we need to have a much more holistic conversation, because when it comes to the questions of why these things happen, there literally is no one answer. And we try to narrow it down oftentimes to say, it's just the guns. Guns are, and the access to guns are definitely a component of it. But there are a number of other things also is worth focusing on, even out of just the entertainment industry.
I'm going to still come back with a question about that. Frank, the fact that we have this powerful organization by the name of the NRA, I have to ask you about that, and the role that it plays overall. Just a general question, because there's lots of coverage about how it's not obviously into any laws that goes against gun ownership. Do you think that, of course, the lobbying money that it spends, do you think that that is a contributing factor? And why is it that they conduct themselves that way, if you agree?
Well, it's definitely a contributing factor. As a high school student many years ago, the NRA was the gun safety organization. I was a member of it. We have our rifle team. And they and the National Guard sponsored it. Somewhere along the line, around 1985 or 86, somewhere there, the thing changed into from a gun safety organization to a much more political, Second Amendment-focused organization, and became a political force based on this religious-like defense of one part of the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So it certainly is a factor. Certainly they've been able to mobilize a sector of the electorate to say absolutely nothing will be done to deal with the gun, that's not the problem. If we only the outlaws will have guns, the outlaw guns, that kind of thing. And I think that was very persuasive to people, to some people. I do believe that an effect. If you didn't have a nationally coordinated pro-gun organization, certainly the laws would be different. There's no question about that. I also think when we're talking about this, because I see we don't have much more time, that in this country, we have racial and ethnic overlays to these problems that are extremely important. And I think that we to underestimate that. We have an interracial type of violence here. We have both, of course, white people shooting white people and black people shooting black people and so forth. We also have this sort of institutionalized violence in a certain way. We have, when we talk about community policing, sure. Who is being policed by whom? There's all these other things that come into play. And I agree with our other person here that it isn't just the gun, but we do have to address each of these factors. I don't see much being addressed. I don't see, for instance, any of the parties saying, okay, here's a list of six different things. Let's fund this, let's fund this, let's do this. Okay, we disagree on number five, but let's get the first four. So I don't see it. And that extends across the spectrum. For instance, early childhood development, a key factor. Well, my party isn't, or the Republican Party in this case, isn't going to fund that stuff for whatever reasons. Well, all of that factors into this. And collectively, you wind up with a disaster.
Okay. Final question goes to you, Malik Abdal. I'd like to talk to you about music in the context of how what's being viewed visually, whether it's in the context of music or movies, culture of gun that's promoted, but in particular, pop and rap have promoted, as you mentioned, I believe, scene, guns are involved, promoted, and it's really highlighted in a way that it's okay. This wasn't part of the research that I did, unfortunately, so I gotta ask for your help here. How much of an impact has that played? Because we know that in terms of the music itself, it is highly listened to in the States, and it ranks at the top in terms of what people listen to. Not, I don't know the demographics of it, but in terms of the way that it contributes to crime, and then overall, when it comes to gun culture promoted in movies, et cetera, if you can also comment on that.
Yeah, so if you look back, I think maybe in the 90s, or could be the 90s, Cedric Tucker, a civil rights activist, she partnered with Tipper Gore, who was the wife of ultimately Al Gore, who was vice president of the United States to Bill Clinton. They went on a campaign, and part of that campaign was waging a war against what they called gangster rap at the time. We've come many, many years since then, but we've seen that these record companies, they do benefit in a way from glorifying violence. Things that they are willing, these record companies, and when we talk about who's most responsible, I don't think that there is any like equal as far as one person is more or less responsible than the other. But I do know if we think about the record companies, you can think of the images, and a lot of these images, they're images of black women, they're images of black men with guns, and not guns in a responsible gun ownership way, but in a very glorified flossing gangster lifestyle. But these, there is no protest of record companies for putting these type of images out there. There are protests in communities against this type of stuff. But I think that there is a discussion to be had about what sort of impact that has. I used to believe, and many people, even back then, they were pushed, the hip-hop community and many pushed back against C. Dolores Tucker and Tipper Gore because they said that they were attacking rappers. But it is worth asking ourselves when we see in our communities that we see many, they're trying to make what they see in these videos. And so that is something we need to consider.
Wish we had more time. Thank you so much, Malik Abdal. We appreciate it. GOP strategist and political analyst from Washington, D.C. Thank you. Jim Spack, thank you. Workers, Independent News, and I wouldn't think that you have a son that's 50 years old. Bless you. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Takwe and the team, it's goodbye on the next program.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.